Well, welcome to our latest edition of the Democracy 2025 Conversation Podcast, Democratic Conversations, which is produced by Content Group. My name's Mark Evans, and I'm Director of Democracy 2025 and your host today. The coronavirus outbreak, as we all know, is a terrible reminder of the importance of political trust to national unity and cohesion. In the latest Democracy 2025 report, How Does Australia Compare? Is It a Leading Democracy?, which is being launched tomorrow, the authors state that combating coronavirus requires significant levels of political trust. Without it, the changes to public behaviour necessary to slow down and ultimately eradicate the spread of infection are slower and more resource intensive. People need to trust the government to support more government intervention that makes a difference. So the focus of our conversation today is on coronavirus and political trust, and whether the Australian system of governance is robust enough to win the trust of its citizens and enable them to follow the measures necessary to contain and ultimately eradicate the virus. We'll look at some of the recent evidence and evaluate the role of government, media, and science in these troubling times. Now, to help us make sense of this watershed moment in contemporary Australian history, I'm delighted to introduce to you neuroscientist and former Vice Chancellor of the Australian National University and Chief Scientist, Ian Chubb, AC. Welcome, Ian.
Thank you, Mark.
And also leading political journalist, editor and author, Michelle Grattan, who is currently Chief Political Correspondent of The Conversation and Professorial Fellow at the University of Canberra. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Ian.
Hi, Michelle.
Now, let me begin by presenting the key findings of the report, just to set the conversation in context. I should say that this report is the product of a research collaboration, which is between Democracy 2025 and the TrustGov project. The TrustGov project is anchored by the University of Southampton and the Kennedy School at Harvard University. The aim of the report was to investigate how Australian attitudes towards issues of trust and democratic practices compare both with other mature liberal democracies and also with other democracies in our region. And it draws on the World Value Survey, which is conducted in over 140 countries. So it's probably the most rigorous comparative survey of public attitudes that we have in the world today. And it's run by some of the top universities in the world as well. So we can say that it does have real academic rigor. So the big question we were interested in relation to this report is whether the Australian system of governance is robust enough to win the trust of its citizens. So what did we find? So there were basically six key observations which emerged in the report. We found, first of all, that Australians are great champions of democracy and, in comparative perspective, have a very positive sense of the achievements of their democracy, its relative importance internationally, and also its ability to deliver various freedoms. Secondly, however, we find that trust in government is standing at the moment at 30%. It's comparatively lower in Australia than most advanced liberal democracies for which we have recent data, and that includes the United States. And the only other two countries that are lower amongst the democracies, the mature democracies, are Spain and Italy, who both experienced the worst excesses of the global financial crisis. And of course, as you know, up until now, Australia's had sort of 28, 29 years of economic growth. It's also very low compared to our regional neighbours, except Japan, which stands at 24%. Thirdly, social trust, and that's trust between people, stands at 49%. That's comparatively low compared to other advanced liberal democracies. Sweden and Switzerland are on top of the charts on that measure at 67%. However, social trust is higher than most of our regional neighbours, with the exception of New Zealand at 56% and China at 64%. Fourthly, in comparison with other countries, Australians do not see government or public institutions as prone to corruption or as prone to corruption as that reported in other countries. Although it's interesting to know that still 66% of Australians think that corruption is present in the wider society and economy. In other mature democracies, it's actually now in the 70s, 80s and 90s, which is remarkable. Fifthly, what Australians lack in trust in parliament, in politicians and political parties, contrasts with their degree of trust in science. So Australia is in the top 8% of countries in the world for trust in science and experts. So by implication, evidence-based policy making should matter. In another project that we're involved in at the moment, we've just analysed 1.4 million tweets mentioning COVID or coronavirus between the 21st and the 27th of March. And we found that the chief medical officer, or Brendan Murphy, the occupant of that office, gets consistently more mentions than the prime minister and the state leaders. In other words, the majority of Australians are following the voice or the formal voice of science on these issues, which is a really interesting finding. And then finally, we also observe that in limited democratic societies, and most of our regional neighbours are limited democratic societies, there is a weak commitment to liberal values, but strong trust in government. Whereas interestingly, in socially liberal societies such as Australia, trust is not automatically granted to government, it needs to be earned. So look, in summary then, the report concludes that a legitimacy gap has emerged in delivering the ideals of democracy through the institutions of Australian democracy and the practices of democracy. So basically, it's the politics that are broken, but socially, we're doing pretty okay. So my first question then, and I'll put this to Michelle to begin with, and then ask Ian to follow up. Why do you think Australians are presently struggling with trusting their politicians and political institutions? Michelle?
Well, firstly, it's part of the general decline in political trust that we've seen in Western countries, and this has been going on, as we know, for a very long time. Specifically in Australia, I think that trust has been increasingly eroded in general terms because we've had a fairly dysfunctional political system over the last decade or so, with the rotation of prime ministers, prime ministerial coups or challenges, coups against prime ministers, and a feeling that really the politicians are serving their own interests more than the community's interests by the internal fight within parties. Also, I think that bad behaviour by politicians, the squabbling as opposed to serious arguments about policy, has put many Australians off our political system. And the fact that we have such a pervasive coverage by media means that we do see the bad behaviour in technicolour, as it were, and the media is also pretty negative, concentrating on the divisions and the arguments. So I think all that does reinforce the distrust people have. However, one interesting thing is that in this crisis, I think now the rubber's hit the road on a big issue, an unprecedented issue in any of our lifetimes. Trust is returning, at least to an extent. And we've had an essential poll which shows that trust in the government to provide honest and objective information is at 56%, which in the present era of general distrust, I think is quite high. So there is an interesting disconnect here between people's general scepticism about the system over a long time and their attitude when they're faced with a big issue and the government response.
It's interesting. So, because we also find that in times of elections, so we find this with the Australian election study, trust goes up because the political attention cycle goes up. So interestingly, in times of crisis, again, the political attention cycle goes up. And basically, the view amongst the citizenry is that they're taken more seriously during that period. Ian, what are your thoughts?
Mark, I very largely agree with Michelle. I think the reason why it's sunk to the low that it's sunk to is because of their behaviour. I think they've brought it on themselves. And the worst aspect of it is that they don't seem to care. And I'm constantly amazed at what I see when I and I'm reasonably engaged in the, as an observer of the political process. How transparent the self-interest is, how patronising it can be, how frequently we are told, you know, the Australians are not mugs, and then we get treated like mugs. I believe that the processes have led to what is a sort of de facto ruling class, and they've forgotten that their actual job is to represent the Australian community and its interests, electorate by electorate, state by state, whichever house they're in. And I think that's basically something that is, you know, for many of them, not all. And the problem is we talk about politicians as if they're all the same, and they patently obviously aren't. Mm-hmm. And there are some excellent people trying to do a hard job in difficult circumstances, and our attitudes get dragged down by the worst. And I think that's a pity. But basically, until they clean up their own house, they can't tell the rest of us how to behave and expect us simply to, you know, tug the forelock and say, of course.
So this sort of idea of bad behaviour in technicolour, as Michelle puts it, is a real issue. So we kind of have this sort of combination of political turbulence, bad behaviour in technicolour, and also this perception that our politics is driven by conflict rather than collaboration and compromise. Those three issues seem to be pretty central to this discussion.
Yes, I think so. And I mean, for example, I applaud the notion of a national cabinet, as it's called. I think clearly in our federation, which can be fractious at times, then bringing together people and talking through the issues freely and frankly, even if some of the state premiers and so on are faced with some different problems because of the dimension of the issue in their states, will do something a bit differently or enforce things more firmly. I think that idea, I'd have had more confidence in it if, for example, it were a genuine war cabinet and the opposition was involved. I don't actually see why this is a politically partisan issue. Now, I know state premiers are of different political parties, but in terms of the federal response, it would seem to me, looking in from the outside, that it would make quite a lot of sense to have the federal parliament involved rather than just the government that got in by 1%. So it's there are steps that could be taken to reassure all of us that the whole of Australia is taken into account in a serious way, and I think the more ideas you have on the table, the better the outcome will be.
Can I jump in on that point? I think one reason, one objective reason why it's probably good not to have the opposition involved is that that does give more freedom for the opposition to provide a critique of what the government or the National Cabinet, for that matter, is doing. If Anthony Albanese was in that National Cabinet, I think that there would be a lot of pressure on him to sign up to precisely what it was doing. And if he didn't, then he'd come under criticism. He has come under criticism anyway from some commentators for differing on certain points, specifically for saying that things should be done more quickly than they have been. But if he was part of the group, then it would be more difficult for him to have any variation of view. Now, I think in the present crisis, it is important for different views to be heard. I think that this line that everybody must be on the same page is not a good one, because there are genuine arguments about how the crisis should be handled, whether it's the health aspect or whether it's the economic aspect.
Thanks, Michelle. Look, I guess the rejoinder to that would be that he would have to abide by conventions of collective responsibility. And that would moderate his behaviour. He would become part of government rather than in opposition to government.
It does seem to me, and I accept that argument. I think it's a perfectly valid argument. And it is true that Albanese has been criticised by certain aspects of the media for daring to say something a bit different, which is different at the margin, not at the core and the principle. And it's interesting how our media plays a role in this these days. But it also seems to me, to reinforce Michelle's point and against my earlier one, I guess, that essentially Parliament has been suspended for however many months now, or we expect it to be. I guess they'll have to call them back if they need to change laws and legislation. But at the moment, I think, is it, Michelle, you would know better than me, but is it till September or something? And so a lot of it will happen in the public domain through having an opposition making constructive contributions to how things could be improved.
I guess that's why the UK is now introducing a virtual parliament.
Yeah.
As a response to that. Michelle?
Just on the timetable, they're due to come back in August, but in fact they will come back, I'd say, within about a fortnight, because the mega package that was introduced this week or announced this week of economic measures does require some legislation, and that'll have to be reasonably urgently passed. Now, it's a big lot of drafting, so it's not instantly back, but it will be back. The Parliament will be back quite soon, briefly, and in mini form.
Yeah.
So can I ask you both, starting with Ian, how well do you think the government is handling the crisis so far?
Well, as far as I can tell, Mark, they're doing the sorts of things that you would expect to be done. I mean, we are, in time-wise, we're a bit behind the rest of the world, so we could learn a lot from what's happened in the rest of the world. I think we're a bit slow off the mark, it would be my view. We could have looked at what's happened in Europe and indeed in China and other places in our region, and we could have seen that fairly strong measures taken early would have been would have had a dampening effect on the spread, and a significant one probably, because we know what they didn't do. And I saw a piece of research that said that if China had done what they actually did but 2 weeks earlier, it would have had a really significant dampening effect on the spread in China, and presumably it's had an influence on the rest of the world. So I think, but broadly, I can't see what else they could have done except done it on a slightly different time base. I certainly wouldn't have let a whatever it is, a love boat dock and disembark its passengers in Sydney, I see that passengers from that ship are now account for roughly 10% of our total in Australia, and that's a significant issue. But we've learned from that, I hope, and that won't happen again. But generally, I think they seem to be doing what you would expect them to do.
I guess the decision to stop the international student traffic, which was made a lot earlier, wasn't it? That appears to have had a decent effect, because clearly our geographical proximity to China, you would have thought would mean that we would take earlier measures, but that was one of the measures that was taken.
They took that early on. Yeah, and it does appear to have had an effect. I mean, we seem to be, I mean, it's hard to tell, isn't it? I mean, I was in a private hospital the other day where they'd have to tie down the hand disinfectant bottles all over the hospital because somebody had come in the night before and stolen them all. Mm. In a pathology centre adjacent, they'd had somebody come in and steal their toilet rolls. I mean, it's a sort of a weird response in many ways, and the importance of it, the significance of it, is probably now growing to a point where we'll be much more compliant with the rules, because Brendan Murphy, as you say amongst the tweets, for example, tells us that this is increasingly urgent and we've got to do things, and increasingly I guess we'll do them. But they seem to be handling it fairly methodically and fairly carefully, and I don't know what else they could do. I don't know enough about it to know what else they could do.
Well, I guess it's been interesting that over the last sort of decade, there's been a big investment in the use of behavioural insights to communicate more effectively with citizens. But actually, all the political messaging has really been very traditional, hasn't it? You know, it's been the big leader and the chief sort of scientist and the scientific authority standing up together and communicating in a very traditional way with the citizens. So, I mean, that's going to raise questions in the future about the sort of investment that's been made in behavioural science in particular, and its lack of impact on government messaging. Michelle, your thoughts?
Well, I think on this question of messaging, it could have been a good deal better. I do think that the early message from government, and indeed from the chief medical officer, that for most people this would be a very mild illness, perhaps put the emphasis on the wrong part of the looming crisis, because it did mean that quite a lot of people, especially younger people who were hearing the signal that, well, this won't affect me a lot, it'll only be like a bad cold or a bit of flu or whatever, they were much harder to get on track later for the need for really tough measures. It's not that the community doesn't agree with those measures in theory, particularly now, and the polling shows that they do overwhelmingly, but many people took a while to obey them. Now, I think if there'd been more balance in that early messaging, it would have been better. And of course, we had things like the Prime Minister saying, "It's fine, I'm going to the football," and then having to change and not go and so on. So I do think that's been a problem in handling. I think in terms of the speed of things, the government was very quick out of the blocks with the measure to stop Chinese students coming in, because of course there would have been a huge influx of people from China coming back to the universities, and so the ban on travel from China was good, but then I think it slowed down a bit, and it would have been better to have done things a week, a fortnight, or whatever earlier. But of course, all this is very easy to say in hindsight.
So there's an issue in terms of how well the messages were targeted, and there's an issue in terms of the swiftness of response potentially. Ian, did you want to come in there?
Well, I was just going to say that basically to say what Michelle just said slightly differently, I think one of the issues that happened very early on was that it became an old person's problem, and when in fact it's a community problem. And if it had been sold from the beginning as a community problem where the old people are more vulnerable in the sense that, you know, the death rate is higher, that's a bit different from basically saying or implying, because I think it was by implication more than overtly, but the idea that it's... an old person's problem, and that the young people might have a minor cold, slight flu-like symptoms by implication. And that meant that people sort of, I think, didn't take ownership of the problem. And going back to the behavioural stuff, I think you're more likely to get the right behavioural changes, which we need and which are terribly difficult to introduce when it's so radical. But you might have got it more quickly when we as a community owned the issue and not just thought it would be compartmentalised and we could dispense with old people or not worry about them too much or whatever it is, and we'll go down the beach and, you know, sit shoulder to shoulder or do whatever it was that we chose to do. And it's a pity that it started out like that, because I think they're now recovering that ground, but it's, but it takes longer to recover it rather than it does to plough it in the first place. So. So they should have, and that's hindsight. But we've had problems in the past. I was talking to a person the other day, and we were discussing how HIV in Australia was addressed basically as a community issue that the community had to solve.
Which was quite controversial at the time, interestingly. People were saying, oh, this is being... talked about, being advertised in much broader terms than is necessary. Now, that was some of the critics at the time. Yeah. But in fact, of course, it was a very savvy approach, because it had an instant effect, or very quick effect.
Very quick, yeah.
So, Ian, this emphasis in the survey data on Australians trusting science, do you think that's a fair representation? And is this a government taking scientific advice seriously?
Well, on the first point, it probably is. I think it's been quite consistent in a number of polls over the years that scientists tend to rate highly in whatever table it is that's constructed. The question that I have had, and probably still do have, is that notwithstanding the trust in scientists, for example, the attitude to climate change, you know, sunk to a low of 40-odd percent, slightly lower, at its trough. And it always struck me as odd that we could trust scientists, but we didn't necessarily trust what they were saying if we didn't want to hear it. So, again, it was a messaging issue, I think, and I used to say this quite often, that oftentimes when scientists go out and speak publicly about an important matter, they're talking to their colleagues and themselves rather than to the audience that they're trying to get to, and that made it a bit tougher. With respect to whether or not they take scientific advice, I'd say it's very patchy. I think clearly they haven't taken scientific advice on a matter like climate change to the extent that they should have. Increasingly now they're acknowledging that it's a problem. And we're seeing it writ large because the barrier reef is bleaching again for the third time in whatever it is, 4 years, and substantially bleaching. So we're seeing some of the impact of that, and we I guess that, you know, and the bushfires, which started out really in that silly way of saying, well, you know, climate change doesn't start bushfires. Nobody ever said that it did. What people said was that it created an environment where the country was tinder dry. And the difference was, yes, we've always had bushfires, but this time we had great difficulty putting them out, and because of the nature of the country at the time. So I think it's patchy. With respect,
but do you think that this might be a big trigger now? This might be a watershed moment in that sense.
I hope so. In your introduction, Mark, you used the expression evidence-based policy, which we all do. We all know that you can put the evidence on the table and there will be an overlay, and it'll be a multiple source of advice a minister or a prime minister will get, and it'll be nuanced in some way. But you would hope that evidence is at the core, even if it's nuanced, as I said. But you would think that a lot of these things are really just showing the importance of understanding and having people who understand, who are making the decisions, who understand why it's important to comprehend the evidence and to let it be a serious component in future policy. I think it's interesting right now that Brendan Murphy is getting the mentions in the tweets that you referred to earlier. I think I can understand why. I think he stands up. He's very, and his deputy indeed, they stand up and they tell it to you, and they look serious and they appear serious. They probably get more. What I don't know is how much of the advice that they're giving the government is actually taken by the government, because there is a total lack of transparency, which we might get onto later, or not enough transparency, not a total lack. And so it's hard to know whether the advice that they're getting by the time it gets through the various filters is actually what they wanted it to be. And then Brendan's in the very difficult position of standing next to the Prime Minister and hearing the Prime Minister say what the advice was. Sometimes it might be, in subtle ways, different from what was actually offered. I don't know, because we don't know.
I think one point of interest in this question of expert advice is that there has been some argument among the experts. Now, that's been smoothed out in that committee of health officials that provides the advice to government and to the National Cabinet. But we do know, for example, that the Chief Victorian Health Officer has been much more gung-ho on what should be done and on the whole issue than some others in that committee. And, of course, we're hearing from experts outside government in the academic world who've been more alarmist than what appears to be the official advice. So I think when we talk about evidence-based advice, we do have to recognise on this issue, perhaps in total contrast to the climate issue, where there's overwhelming unanimous advice with only very few outliers, that in the last few weeks there have been legitimate and arguable differences between experts.
I guess the key question, Ian, is whether the best science is getting a hearing. And I think you're saying that we don't really know whether that's the case or not.
I am. And on Michelle's point, I think it's perfectly correct, obviously, that there are alternative views and sometimes very strongly put. The point is, how does a government getting all this differing advice, how does it respond to that? And I think that creates a problem. I'm not saying it's not a problem they shouldn't have to grapple with, but it does create an issue. So somewhere along the line, it will get synthesised into a consensus view. And as long as the government knows that there are some outliers to that consensus, then I think it's an appropriate way of handling it. Otherwise, I mean, I don't want the Prime Minister to be getting his advice by listening to the radio and reading a newspaper where somebody will have a view that will be quite different from the advice that he's getting. I don't think they're wrong to put the advice on the table. I think there will always be options available in a complex issue like this, and the option should be put. But somebody with knowledge and expertise ought to be stitching the fabric together rather than leaving it to politicians to say, well, we've had 27 different bits of expert advice, and they're all experts, I'm not questioning that, put out there in the public domain, which of them will we choose? I want experts putting it together and saying this is the best way forward, and here are some of the legitimate outlier issues that you also need to at least be aware of.
So it's that translation and synthesization issue that's really important in relation to making sure that the evidence is translated in a meaningful way for policy.
I think so, yeah.
Can I just illustrate with one point about this? The government asked the group of eight universities to get together more than 20 experts to give their opinions. And out of that came a report where the majority of those experts went for really, really tough measures and response to the crisis, and the minority went for a more staged approach. Now, the government took up the more staged approach, or at least it didn't vary its approach to go down the majority path at that point. So I think that does show that there's diversity among those who really know about these things, and that a government will balance what it hears from the experts with what it sees as other imperatives. So I think over the last few weeks, what we saw was one school of thought saying, deal with the health crisis and then deal with the economic one, while the other school of thought, led by the federal government, was saying we have two simultaneous crises.
Yeah,
and it was clear in the early days that the economic argument was winning, really. But now that seems to be coming back into kilter. And it'd be interesting to see how far the Prime Minister was responding to what was happening in the United States at that point, because clearly that was Trump's original approach: avoid damage to the American economy at all costs. So look, Michelle, given that the trust in media is as low as trust in government politicians and political parties, particularly in the social media area, how do you think the media is faring in its reporting of the pandemic?
Well, again, to reference the Essential poll, which is really up-to-date information on this, the media is being better regarded now than it was a week or two ago, but still, I think, not overwhelmingly trusted or seen as a place where you go for reliable information. But its performance is seen as improving. It's been rather paradoxical because the effect of this whole crisis on the media has been twofold. On the one hand, it's bringing an enormous audience to the media. So the media websites are finding that they're getting far, far more hits than they were before. So people are hungry for information and they do see the media as an important source of information. And as I say, they're increasingly thinking it's an authoritative source of information. On the other hand, of course, because the economy is collapsing, advertising is also collapsing. So the media is taking a big hit on that side. So that's interesting development, I guess, from the media's point of view. But I think overall the coverage has been mixed. Sometimes the media's been criticised for being alarmist, but of course, as the reason for alarm has been dramatically increasing, that criticism, I think, falls away. I think that the media has been serving the community in the broad pretty well during this time.
So, Ian, in respect to the reporting of science, as Michelle said, there's been some alarmist reporting. But what does the media need to do to ensure that it has balanced reporting on the science underpinning the pandemic?
Stick to the facts. I mean, I think it's an opportunity for some parts of the media to to move away from opinion masquerading as fact and to stick to the facts and to inform rather than to seek to persuade to a particular point of view. Of course, you hope they persuade people to follow the, you know, the best rules and what we're being asked to do to prevent the spread and so on. So persuasion is a legitimate part of what they do. I agree with Michelle. I think that in the beginning it was strange, really, when we had only 50 cases. There was a sort of complacency. But they were being told on a daily basis that this was going to be an exponential growth issue, and as the numbers grew, then it got alarmist. And now I think it's much more reasonable. Generally, I think and most of it is just fact based. There are this many people. This is the distribution. This is what we'll get the newspapers this morning detailing what different states are requiring of people who live in those states and territories, I think is important because some things get lost in the message. You know, can you go out and exercise? The answer is yes. But when oftentimes you only hear about, you're only allowed out to go shopping and to go to the pharmacy or the doctor, in the sort of summary form. So I think there is a role to play, and I think that generally speaking, I think they're playing it quite well.
So, Michelle, are you seeing kind of an increase in fact-checking capability across the media?
Well, I think the media are in the main trying to get the facts right, but because everything is moving so quickly and because government is sort of overwhelmed by all this, sometimes it's actually quite hard to check points fast enough or to get to the right people, the right bureaucrats, the right people in ministers' offices, whatever. It's a very, very fast-moving situation. I think people are trying to check facts and, on the whole, that's probably working okay, but with difficulty.
So we're kind of learning as we're doing, really, aren't we? I mean, according to all of the projections, we're still very much at the infancy of this pandemic. So clearly there's going to be we're already seeing a boredom factor impacting on people's viewing and listening habits in terms of the media. So how are the media going to ensure that they retain the sort of public attention over the medium to long term?
Well, I think that people will be obviously drawn to the media to get facts, because as this develops and as it is likely to get significantly worse before it gets better, people will want to know what's happening, what they need to do, restrictions and so on. So I think that their attention will be retained because they need the information. It's not discretionary, really. And, of course, one of the notable factors in all this is that there are no other stories going, at least in terms of the media's coverage, while things are quite difficult in terms of getting reporters out and about and people having to work from home and so on. There's no need to give attention to any other stories because they're really not there anymore. It's amazing.
Yeah, look, it is interesting that the most listened to and watched programs at the moment are reruns of old football matches, old Sydney Swans matches, etc.
Oh, watching them all.
Yeah. but people are already starting to get a bit bored with them as well. So it's going to be interesting how things develop over the next period. So look, let's try and bring some of these themes together and think about the future a bit now. So Michelle, what do you think are the broader lessons that can be drawn from the pandemic for the development of public policy more generally?
One of the difficulties in answering this is we're going to be in a completely different world when we get out of this. And so it's really hard to see the shape of that world. It's probably easier to see the economic shape of it, in the sense that we know that things will be really bad, that on the budgetary front, the idea of debates about surpluses can be put off for, I think, several political generations, in, as it were, because we know the cost of this is just going to be so enormous. But in terms of that world, I think it will show the desirability of moving beyond the hyper-partisanship that we've seen in recent years, the fights over absolute trivia. And while obviously partisanship will return to a greater degree than it's existing now, the community will be impatient with the sort of political debate that we've had in recent years. They'll want their politicians to concentrate on the main challenges, and those challenges will be huge. And apart from the partisanship issue, I think that one of the lessons out of this crisis so far is the importance of making the federation work better. We are seeing federalism actually work very well. There have been differences between the federal government and New South Wales and Victoria in particular, but they're differences that are productive rather than destructive. And therefore, I think that we will see some rethinking of the need to keep the Federation working post-crisis as it's working during the crisis.
So it could be a key corrective to the way in which our federalism has become so much more centralised than I think the founding mothers and fathers envisaged, the importance of moving away from hyper-partisanship and greater emphasis on collaborative problem solving. Ian, your thoughts?
Well, I agree with those ones. I think one of the more irritating aspects of politics over the last little while has been the hyper-partisanship that Michelle mentioned. And I think when you remember that a government wins a majority with 50-point-something% of the vote, and in Australia it's usually just over 50, it's not, you know, overwhelming. And the interests of the Australian people should be at the forefront of the whole political process, and I don't think they have always been. So I agree with that. I think that's important, and that the Federation works better. I think one lesson to learn is transparency. I think for too long now, we listen to, we can't tell you about that because it's a security matter, or it's an on-water matter, or it's inside a bubble, or however it's expressed. When in fact, I think if you take people into your confidence, you're more likely to be able to explain the nuances and the necessary nuances of policy response to a particular issue, which is rarely going to be in this complex world of ours a black and white solution to most things. And if we know why you're taking a particular position and have it explained clearly, then I think the chances of having higher regard for the process that leads to that decision will be self-evident. So I'd say transparency has got to be important, and I would say that's about the present thing too. And I notice now they're going to release their modelling data and so on, which I think is important, because a lot of people are giving opinion, including people like me, without actually knowing the basis of the decisions that have been made and the basics behind it. So I would put transparency up. I think there are going to be a lot of other little issues that will be quite important. I mean, at the moment, people will be most people will be understand why it's necessary to track people through their mobile phones. I don't think that we would want to see that continue as soon as the crisis is over. So So getting powers repealed that were appropriate for a particular time that are not any longer in a democracy, then we need to be quite alert that a lot of the things that are in place or will be put in place, which, you know, people like me would support, because I think it is important that we know that people get off a boat or a plane and are indeed self-quarantining and isolating and all the rest of it for the protection of us all. But that they're no longer there. So there will be things like that that I think in our democratic process we should be quite alert to. And I noticed that I think it was the Commissioner Police in New South Wales was saying he would be happy when it was all given back, as it were. I mean, I'm paraphrasing what he said, but giving those powers back. And that's good that they're thinking like that. But the legislators have got to make sure that they enable that to happen. So there'll be, I reckon, a string of things like that. But a lot of it, I think, Mark, will depend on what sort of society we are. It's not possible to do what we're now doing and expect the same sort of society to come out the end of it. Mm. And if it's 6 months, 12 months, who knows? We don't know. But if it's 6 months, which the Prime Minister is talking about, then will we be the same as a society? And I suspect the answer to that is no. How different we will be, how could you know? I don't know. But I don't think it'll be the same. So how we respond when we're through it will be quite an interesting challenge for Australian leadership in all dimensions, media, academia, political, business, the works will need to be working very hard to make sure that we begin to cohere in some form in a way and in a country and in a democracy that we would like to be.
Yeah, some really powerful insights there. So obviously during crisis, we need greater transparency, we need more open government, and we need more authentic political communication. But looking forward, there are likely to have been a slip in civil liberties questions. And this whole issue of what type of society do we want to be? That whole question. I mean, it's interesting that a number of organisations like the New Democracy Foundation and others are arguing now that we need to have kind of a constitutional convention around that question. Mm. You know, that there's a whole range of different events that have combined to actually bring us into a situation where we need to pause and reflect on what type of society we want to be, and by implication, what type of government we require to support that society.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
The million-dollar question to you both then is, given all of these issues that we've discussed, what needs to change to bridge the trust divide between government and citizen? Michelle?
Well, you're right, it's a million-dollar question without any simple and obvious answer. But I think that one thing that needs to change is, going back to where we started, the behaviour of politicians needs to change. They do need to use this as some sort of reset to look beyond petty squabbling and try to collaborate to an extent. I don't want to exaggerate this, but collaborate to an extent on broader issues, so that people have more faith in the fact that everything isn't being fought over just for the sake of a fight. Yes, you need robust political debate about the right solutions to problems, but you don't need petty bickering and backbiting and point scoring and culture wars. That is not the way forward. And I might just note that there is an element of culture war even going on during this crisis, which is unfortunate to see. But I do think that politicians will need to lift their gazes, as it were, when this is all over, and try to say, well, let's be a little more statesmanlike and a little less just fighting in the gutters.
So there's an integrity challenge that we need to confront, particularly in relation to the bad behaviour of politicians. And also there appears to be an issue to do with how responsive government is to the citizenry, and this kind of perception that the political class has become more disconnected from the government, from the people it serves. Ian, what would you add to that?
Well, I think they're very important points, and I think it's where it starts, because that's where the leadership of the country, largely resides. I mean, there are other people who have leadership roles in various industries or parts of the society who have a part to play too. But at the end of the day, it will be the governments of the country that write the laws. And, I've often complained about the fact that the rules they write for themselves are more lenient than the rules they write for everybody else in the country. Why is that so? Mm-hmm. Why do we accept that? There aren't any robocalls if a person misuses their travel allowance. There are if you're suspected of doing something, and the debt collectors are sent in if you don't respond within a relatively small amount of time. So I just think that the politicians have, in my view, a lot of them, not all of them, as I said earlier, have lost the sense that they're representing us. And as a bit of a fan of Henry Parkes, I will say that back in his Tenterfield speech, there was a report in a local journal, a journal, where they talked about, and I'm paraphrasing, how good it was to hear a statesman referring to the aspirations or representing the aspirations of a people. And I think we get much less of that now. Now is a different time and a different, and I know all of that, and I know I'll be criticised for saying something so silly. But the reaction basically was that the community got behind people with principles and leadership, even if they were odd people. And I think that we need principles to be re-emphasised in the political process. I think we need leadership. I think we need persuasive leadership and principled leadership, and in leadership within integrity. And when we see sports rorts, as it's called, and all the rest of it happening, what do we do? I mean, 2 million odd of us last year chose not to vote or vote validly during an election campaign. Now we could say, oh, yeah, well, that's not too bad. But 2 million votes swings elections in this country, and people ought to have a view, and leaders ought to know that they will be held accountable for what they do and for what they don't do. And I think it's become a bit too complacent, and the people who are switching off are not serving us well as a community, because it becomes an issue of the punters will forget. So there's an election time coming around, we'll run around, it'll be vote for us because we aren't them. And then something bad happens, the bushfires, the punters will forget. So I think there's got to be a lot more integrity, a lot more respectable behaviour, respectful behaviour, and a lot more transparency in taking the public into its confidence so that it can understand why things are being done, some of which should be and will need to be uncomfortable.
Some really powerful insights there. I guess there's one sort of area that we haven't pursued in any detail. And on a positive note to end with, and that would be around sort of transnational evidence-based policy making. I suppose I've become a bit of a nerd recently, but I followed the whole proceedings of the WHO, the conference that was held recently. And it was fascinating to watch the scientists come together to provide their views on the issue. And then they had a number of sort of translators of the science, sort of translating the science in a meaningful way for policy. So that gave me some hope that we're starting to see a return to transnational evidence-based policymaking that focuses more on the long term rather than short-term political imperative? Or is that just me being overly optimistic, do you think? Michelle?
Maybe a bit overly optimistic, because we have seen, of course, a very mixed response by countries to this crisis. And certainly what's happened in America, I think, doesn't give a lot of confidence on any particular level. So even the WHO in the early stages seemed to be a bit slow off the mark, I thought. But nevertheless, there are some green shoots in terms, as the saying goes, in terms of the expertise being brought together internationally.
And I think, Mark, that it has to happen. I mean, when you think of the big problems that confront humanity, whether it's this particular one or whether it's climate, whether it's food, you know, feeding 9 billion people in the not too distant future, water supplies, it won't be. You know, there are serious people who say that the next war will be fought over water. And because of the, for all sorts of complex reasons, but yeah, we can guess what they are. Mm. So a lot of these things are only going to be resolved, if not solved, by international collaboration, and that will mean the scientists who instinctively work together anyway. It's a question of how their voices are heard when they come through. So I think that resolves again the. Relates back to the issue of how the political processes work together. A former American, she's not a former American, an American colleague of mine, former, once said in a speech that she gave that we have to manage the unavoidable while we avoid the unmanageable. Mm. And I think that we can only contemplate doing that with a substantial commitment of people across the world, even though we come back to our own governments and our own democracies and our own sovereign rights, we really do have to learn from each other in a way that is influential and changes the way we go about some things for the betterment of us all.
That's a great thought to end with, Ian. Thank you to Ian Chubb and Michelle Grattan for sharing your ideas with us today. What is clear from our conversation is that in times of crisis, we need concerted action to strengthen our democratic practices. But we need to do that in a united, collaborative way. So we look forward to you joining us next time for another democratic conversation. In the meantime, many thanks to Ian and Michelle.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.